Welcome to Wine for Normal People, the podcast for people who like wine, but not the snobbery that goes with it. I'm your host, Elizabeth Schneider, author of the Wine for Normal People book and certified wine dork. This podcast is sponsored by Wine Access, rated the best wine club by New York Times Wirecutter and the official partner and wine provider of the Michelin Guide. This is the best place to discover limited production wines from around the world. Join my wine club with Wine Access. Go to wineaccess.com/normal. Check it out today and listen in the middle of the show for more details. So I am solo again this week, but I am planning to have a couple of listeners on the show to help me out eventually. And this podcast is inspired by my friend and patron, Amy Payton, who I love. She is the best. She's super smart and she has such great questions. And she made the suggestion that we should do a podcast on the history of oak barrels and where the heck they came from. And then after we go through this whole lineage and history, which is very cool, and I need to thank Amy because she really let me go down the rabbit hole on this one. And for those of you who like history and dork out moments, this is the show for you. Then she also wanted to know, how do winemakers get the wine barrels? And what about buying old barrels versus new barrels? And are oak barrels sustainable? I think that's a big question. I did actually address that in episode 449 with Craig Holm from Radu, which is a barrel maker. Really good episode. But it is an interesting question, and I do have an answer for you, Amy. So I just want to give a shout out to all the patrons. Remember that if you want old episodes of the podcast and you want to listen to episode 449, that's a perk of Patreon now. So you would go to patreon.com/wineforNormalPeople and sign up, and you will have access to the old episodes of the podcast. And because the show is listener supported and also supported by Wine Access, we give our thank you. We have the attitude of gratitude, as I like to say, give our thank you every week to the people that make the show possible, who are our patrons. So let me give some shout outs to Clarissa K, Adam H, Alan W, Steph K, Spiros F, Kia, Allison, Abigail G, Matt W, Chris C, Josh E, another Matt W, and James F. Thank you all so much for joining and for getting access immediately to the back episodes of the podcast and for your general awesomeness. And coming up here, I've got some travel, but I'm going to squeeze in some hangouts. We're going to do a mini class on Tavel if you're a wine lover or higher level, and so much fun stuff. It's a great community. In this world where we're sort of not so connected, it is really nice to have a place, even if it's online, to connect. So it's a great community of people. And, you know, for people who really love wine like you, you should definitely join. All right, let's get to Amy's questions. I'm going to confess that you guys know that I love history stuff. And this one really took me down some roads. And actually, I'm so glad that Amy asked this question because it allowed me to clarify a couple of things. Like, what is a Celt person exactly? Because that's a really confusing question. I know it sounds like it's not, but it is. All right, so let's start out with this. I'm just going to lay down the ground rules. So oak barrels, they have been intertwined with wine for almost 2,000 years. There's definitely been ebbs and flows with it, and certainly now it's more flow than ebb, although it has moderated. It used to be everything was oak, and now we've got concrete, and we've got an amphora, the newfangled amphora, and we've got stainless steel. So there's a lot of different stuff now. For a while, it was just oak. But oak was first used as a container purely for transport. There were some serious problems with previous solutions for transporting wine, which I'll explain. And then eventually they decided, well, you know, we could ferment in this vessel also because it doesn't leak. And then also, you know what? The longer we leave it in this wooden thing, it seems to pick up some good flavors and we can age wine in it too. So the uses really wound up evolving. First, we had just transport, and then it went to aging. So it is impossible. I'm saying that oak has been used with wine for thousands of years. And we think that's probably true from the writings, but let's be clear. It's not like amphora where you could find a shard of an amphora or a whole amphora in an archaeological dig. With wood, it's going to biodegrade. This is the sustainability because it is sustainable in that way because when you're done with wood, it is just going to biodegrade and there's going to be nothing left. So we have to rely on writings and stories to know whether or not oak was used, where it was used, and all that kind of stuff. And we will get into that now. Before barrels. The first thing that they used before barrels were animal skins. Now, this was used for storage and transport. I gotta admit, I was kind of thinking of like goatskin canteens or like these little leather things that you would drink the wine out of individually. Well, from what I read, the wines were made in earthenware jars, which is essentially pottery, and they were stored in goatskins. But the way that it is described in a lot of sources is that it held up to a barrel of wine. So that means you would skin a goat, I guess you would sew it together, and because the skin would be stretchy, you would put a lot of wine in that thing. This is how it's described actually in the Old Testament. If you had bigger quantities, you would put it in ox skins. That's like a cask of wine. So these animal skins were not just for individual use, they were for storage. This is very common in the Middle East, in Greece, and somewhat in ancient Rome. The problem is they decomposed over time, they leaked, and they were horrible at transporting long distances. They would fall apart, wine would be everywhere. Not good for wine. Also, the flavor, everything. So animal skins were not a great solution, but they were used for a really long time. Then we had the home of where we believe winemaking began in Europe, in Georgia, maybe Armenia, but Georgia had the kfervi. Now, these were invented probably around 6,000 BCE. And these are large, round clay pots that are coated with beeswax because already at this point, they knew got to slow oxidation. So the wax was stopping some of that oxidation from happening. This is something that people who made wine figured out really early. You have to make sure that wine is not in contact with oxygen if you want it to last more than a few days. The kfervi were stored in the ground that maintained a stable temperature. These were kind of the first underground storage caves, if you will, but they were actually just holes in the ground. And it also prevented cracking by having them cool down as the carbon dioxide built up during fermentation. Problem with these things is that they were big and they were round and they were just too fragile to travel easily. They really just needed to stay in the ground where you buried them. Also, not a great solution. Enter amphora. Yay, amphora. Okay, this is the Bronze Age, 3300 to 1200 BCE. This is where we're talking, right? Who hasn't been to a museum? You see amphora, the Egyptians. The Egyptians were like, yes, this is the solution. We love making pottery. We like designing it. And actually, you can see them on some of the ancient Egyptian pottery. If you go to museums where, you know, they have all the process of winemaking, picking the grapes and making wine and storing it in amphora, on the amphora themselves, they'll draw that and in other pieces of pottery and things like that. So this solution actually quickly spread throughout the Mediterranean. Amphora were tall and they were narrow and they were super useful. There was a couple of reasons for that. First of all, again, everybody recognized that oxygen is the enemy of wine. So they made them so they had these tiny little necks. And that meant that only a small surface area of the wine got exposed to air. That limited the destruction of the wine. Also, they could use it for aging wine. Ancient Egyptians really loved to age wine, but the problem was they couldn't really age it for even a year because the hot summers in ancient Egypt would cook the wine, and they didn't have any preservatives at that point. So wine really couldn't stay good for longer than not even a year. You couldn't go harvest to harvest because of the summer. Eventually, they put stuff like honey and spices in, and that added some longevity to the wine, and that wouldn't make the wine turn to vinegar right away, but it also altered the flavor of the wine. And older wines were prized. In fact, in King Tut's tomb, each of the hundreds of wine bottles were stamped with the vintage. Obviously, royalty found aged wine to be very important enough to be in King Tut's tomb, frankly. This also was super popular with Greeks and Romans. You probably heard me talk about Falernian and Sorrentine wines. These were sweetened wines, and so that actually was sort of the preservative that helped them age. But they were really highly valued. In fact, aged wines and the flavors of aged wines were so prized that they started to figure out, well, like, how could we mimic that? Let's see how we could maybe figure that out. So they started smoking the inside of the amphora in what's called a fumarium, and that would impart characteristics of age that were associated with famous wines. So the smokiness, I guess, maybe flintiness. I can't imagine that that wouldn't be over the top, but who knows? It sounds like they sold for some good money, so good on them. All right, then around 1500 BC, they started to modify the amphora a little bit. You know, in the essence of the Georgian Kvarvi, they started lining them with wax, and then they would seal the top with a clay stopper, but the goal was to get it really, really tight. So this was tighter than their previous solutions for topping off or covering the top of the amphora. And this was to hold aging wines. What they realized is, okay, we're going to put this really tight seal on. There's not going to be any oxygen getting in. And now we're going to be able to age these for a longer time. The Egyptians did this, and also the Greeks. Amphora were a great improvement over animal skins because you could transport them, not without some trouble. So if you put them on ships, you'd have to put a bunch of sand down and then kind of stick them in because they didn't have flat bottoms. Or you'd string them up by the handles on ships, and that would prevent them from breaking. You couldn't just let them roll around because that's what's not going to work. They were going to break. The problem is they're still made out of clay, and they would often break if they were dropped. And certainly, it doesn't really seem like a great idea to string them up by their handles on ships, but I guess somebody thought that was a good idea. Because you would think if there was a strong wind or waves or something, if that would break it, there'd be wine everywhere. Anyway, there were in every large wine shipment losses. This was not a great solution. Again, people were getting a little frustrated with amphora, and this was worth a lot of money. And the other problem is, okay, let's say they make the journey, you get them to your customer. As soon as you open the wine, a lot of times the amphora would crack and wind up all over the floor. So you'd have to have a vessel to catch the wine because you knew that the amphora would probably break. So they were single use. In around 2500 BCE, we know that there were palm wood casks, so palm trees, shipping Armenian wine to Babylon. The early Greek historian in 500 BC, Herodias, talked about research that said about 2,000 years prior, they were shipping wine in palm wood casks. Palm wood was an exception, and it was something that people thought was a good idea. The problem is it's so hard that it's hard to bend. The wood was used, and it was used for honey and water and food and materials, and they took a lot longer to make than amphora because it took a lot of skill to make them. They lasted longer than the amphora. You certainly could reuse them, but the wood itself just wasn't a great solution, so that never took off. There were also these open wooden buckets. They were used for storage as early as 3000 BC in ancient Egypt. Then people started using them for transporting wine at least from 500 BCE. And in Mesopotamia, again, Herodias talked about wines being floated down the Tigris and Euphrates in these buckets that were sitting on rafts made of reeds. And they were going down the river to sate the thirst of people far away. The wine merchants were making some good money off of this. But the problem, again, it was palm wood. And the Mesopotamians couldn't really work with it. It wasn't supple. It wasn't bendable. It wasn't cheap. The buckets were really difficult to make. They just didn't become widespread. Enter the Iron Age. This is 1200 to 600 BCE. They're still kind of experimenting with these buckets. But now, if we move over from Mesopotamia and we move to Western Europe, now we can use some different tree matter to make these open barrels. And in France and in other places, they started to make these open barrels. And at this point, they decided to use them for fermentation of wine. So now we're starting to see the evolution of this wood start to come in. Okay, well, the amphora is a little bit of a pain. So let's move this over to these small open barrels. No lid during fermentation because they didn't want it to blow off from the CO2. So this is basically an open top fermenter. Then when fermentation was done, they nailed a lid onto the barrel and transported it for sale. They were made from a range of wood and they were not constructed perfectly well. But we're definitely getting closer to answering Amy's question of where the heck did oak barrels come from? Because now, maybe not oak, but different kinds of wood, and we're definitely fermenting in these things and we're storing them. But then we have the Greeks. The Greeks set up in Marseille, which is at the bottom of the Rhone River on the Mediterranean, and they started setting up the trading post there. As they were doing this, this was around 600 BC or 500 BCE, they met the Celts. The Celts were tribes that were all over Europe. And I am going to explain what a Celt is because I think when we think, at least for me, when I think about Celts, I think about Celtic art. I think about Ireland and Scotland, and I think about Galicia and Spain. I don't really associate the Celts with the rest of Europe. Now, that may be my own ignorance, but I sort of think of Celts being from Ireland or Scotland and Spain. Okay, so I looked this up. National Geographic described the Celts as a culture with shared belief systems and a common language, versions of which are still spoken in Western Europe, especially in Ireland and Scotland. They're not a unified people, but a bundle of shared linguistic and cultural traits distributed among various Iron Age peoples who profoundly shaped pre-Roman Europe. So the Celts were contemporaries with the Greeks. And these Celtic tribes were migrating across Eastern Europe and across what was then called Gaul, France, and they met up with the Greeks. The Greeks were still using amphora at this point. The amphora were coated with resin. They'd also add that resin to the juice. We can see the origins of Retsina there. They're using some of the resin to actually make airtight seals. But the Celts were already making barrels. And remember that because this was the Iron Age and the Celts were iron workers, they started making the hoops for barrels and they were making wine barrels. As the Greeks got pushed out and the Romans came in, we had Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar in the first century BCE conquered Gaul. And he said this, "We call them Gauls, though in their own language, they are called Celts." So whenever I refer to the Gauls, they are also the Celts or the people formerly known as the Celts. The Roman Empire reached Gaul, France. Now they had a problem because they needed to transport stuff, food and weapons and all this other stuff, but wine was very important. And you were not allowed to make wine in any place except Rome and around Rome. All of the profits were going back to Rome. So they needed to ship wine from Rome into France, other parts of Italy, and all of the rest of the empire that they were conquering. They did not have a reliable transport system. And they really needed wine because it provided calories for the troops who were most likely malnourished, and it gave the soldiers a buzz, which allowed them to continue to fight and deal with all of the psychological fallout of being in a war or being pillagers or conquerors or whatever they are. But they realized these clay amphora are a giant pain. And the Romans knew that the Greeks and the Egyptians had used palm wood barrels, but when they met the Gauls, they realized, this is the solution. The Gauls had been making barrels in northeast France, according to Pliny the Elder. Yes, I was able to get that in. I feel really good. But according to Pliny, the original barrels were made in the Alps by the Celts. The Celts knew nothing about wine. They certainly weren't making wine at the time. They were making beer and putting beer into barrels. The word Cooper for barrel makers comes from the Cisalpine regions of Roman France. So now you have the Romans, they came over, they took over Gaul, and they said, okay, now here's wine, you should buy this wine so that you can give us money. And then they changed the rule and said, okay, you can grow grapes now. And the Gauls became obsessed with wine. Now, of course, they had these lovely barrels. And Gauls were making them out of the wood that was most abundant near them. And that material, Amy, was oak. We'll take a step away from the podcast to thank our sponsor this week and every week, Wine Access. Wine Access tells the story behind every wine. You're transported with every glass you pour. Wine Access is definitely the best place to discover limited production wines from around the world. Case in point, the next shipment of the Wine Access Wine for Normal People Wine Club, which you can join at wineaccess.com/normal, wineaccess.com/normal, is off the beaten trail wines. These wines are not things that you are going to find very easily. They are unique things that occasionally we talk about, but they're not easy to access. There's a Veltalina, there's a Armenian Voskat in this next shipment. There's a Chardonnay from Patagonia in Argentina, and so much more. The wine club is $150 four times a year. You get six bottles, all hand selected by me. If you want to support Wine Access and get great wines, go to the website wineaccess.com/WFMP. Check out a page of wines that I'm loving. Get 10% off your first order. And they have a buy and hold feature. If you get to $150, you get free shipping. That saves you a ton of money, by the way. You can wait up to a month and add things to your cart until you get to $150. And then you can get free shipping on that. Go to wineaccess.com/normal to join the wine club, or wineaccess.com/WFMP. Get 10% off your first order. And don't forget, back episode of the podcast, if you're looking for them, join Patreon. That is now a perk of Patreon, patreon.com/wineforNormalPeople. You can also get hangouts, discounts off classes, lots of fun content that is not available anywhere else. That's what you'll get with your Patreon membership. And if you're interested in classes, I'm about to pop some new ones up there now, wineforNormalPeople.com/classes. Now let's get back to the show. So there we go. We went from animal skins, that we had Fairy clay, we had earthenware here and there, we had amphora for a really freaking long time, toyed around with palm wood, and here we are with oak. Now, oak wasn't the only material used, but it was so abundant, and the Egyptians wouldn't have used it, the Greeks wouldn't have used it, because there isn't a lot of oak in the warmer Mediterranean. It's too warm and dry. Oak forests and oak need water. They need a little bit of humidity. Interestingly, tonneau is the French term for barrel, and that comes from a Celtic word. So there you go. And remember that tonneau word, because I got another factoid about that later. As this became the preferred vessel by 300 AD, the wooden barrel was totally widespread. It was a great shape. It encouraged easier transportation. So you could roll it, they could stack it. It was really easy to take the wine out of. It didn't break, and it could be reused as opposed to an amphora that would break as soon as you opened it. It took a while, but the barrels definitely replaced amphora. And because of their awesome construction, because, you know, barrels aren't made with glue, they are stacked together really, really tight using these metal hoops. Well, you have microoxygenation, but they don't leak and they don't break, and they allow small amounts of oxygen in, but you don't have to add spices or sugar. There's not going to be spoilage. It's pretty airtight. Also, at this point, it wasn't really a throwaway culture. If the barrel leaked or it broke, they could repair it. So it wasn't the end of it. They could continue to use it. Also, pop the top off. Super easy to clean a barrel. It is better hygiene, so the wine was tasting better. It was big, but not too big. So the size made an easy ferment. So you could ferment the wine in it, and it would usually complete fermentation, and it would do a good job. The wine would ferment to dryness or almost dryness. So the Romans at first decided we are going to use this just for transport. But then they started doing things like fermenting the wine in there. And then they left it as they were transporting the wine. And what they noticed is that there was a big difference between when they put the wine in the barrel and when they took it out and tasted it. It was smoother. It tasted like some different things. And so storage and that dream of aging wine for a really long time without oxygen now became realized through the use of these wooden barrels. And again, not really a very wasteful culture. They could use wood as building materials after they were done with barrels. I'm trying very hard not to say an oak barrel, although oak was used at this time. They had pine, chestnut, which is still used in Italy. They had redwood, acacia. You'll find that in parts of Europe as well. Bordeaux, actually, you'll sometimes see that for the whites. But ultimately, oak won out. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Oak is softer, so it's really easy to bend. The way that you make a barrel is that you get a very straight portion of wood. We put the hoop on the top. You put it over a flame and slowly bend it into these staves. And then you put the hoop on the bottom and push it together really tightly. Oak is a tight grain. And so when you make a barrel, it's waterproof, it's leak-proof. And again, oak is very available in Europe. So what we see is that wooden barrels continue to be used in the Middle Ages, especially in Bordeaux and other seaside destinations where shipping wine to other regions was common. So you see that in Oporto, in Portugal, and you see it in Italy. The wooden barrels were very, very important in terms of shipping wine out. Another problem, though, for oak, for wine, is that it had some competition. The wood that was so very important was precious. And it was precious because they used oak to build naval fleets. And during the 1500s to the 1700s, you had a lot of people who wanted to build fleets. Louis XIV, for instance, ordered the forest of Tronchet in France to be replanted because he wanted the wood for fleets. Napoleon did the same thing 100 years later. And they kept planting and replanting because they knew that the demand for wood was going to be there. By the late 1800s, when steel became preferred for boats, there was more wood available for wine barrels. But in this period, they still had enough, but it was definitely a matter of the wood being used for ships. And that gets back to that whole tonneau thing. So tonnage is the carrying capacity of a ship. Well, the term comes from the tax paid on tons or casks of wine. So when you hear tonnage, you should be thinking, ah, that comes from wine, because it does. So that's a very cool fact. Today, winemakers obviously know the impact of the oak barrel and what it's going to bring to their wines. And most barrels are tailored to a particular winemaker. So you decide what you like, what toast level you like, whether you want the head toasted, the closure toasted. Usually what happens, and this goes to Amy's question of how are barrels obtained, usually because they are really expensive. So a French oak barrel can be anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000 US. French oak, it's more expensive than American oak. And if you're going to buy that and invest in it, you better make sure that you really, really like it. A barrel salesperson will come and they might give you samples of wines that have been aged in that barrel. They may talk about the different characteristics of it. But if you're a small winemaker, you're on a budget, or even if you're a big winemaker and you're just not sure, usually you might buy one or two of the barrels. You'll put some wine in it and see how they do. If you like those barrels, you may wind up buying more of them. But usually what happens is that wineries have barrels from a lot of different cooperages, because each one is bringing something a little bit different. You might have something from a different forest. You might have something from a different cooper. You might just like the way that certain barrels are put together. So the way that winemakers choose barrels is based on the flavor profile that they're looking for and what they're trying to get out of the wine. Some really want a lot of neutral oak. Some want more toasted oak. It's all about the individual winemakers, and the barrels are suited to that particular person. Let's get back to the difference between French and American oak very quickly. I don't want this to turn into a barrel lesson. We're not going to go into that now, but I want to talk about the differences between these two things because it is important. The European wood is Quercus Petraea. That is the main oak species. There's one other that's used. This is grown in several parts of mainly France. You have Allier, Limousin, Nevers, Tronchet, and Vosges. These were forests that were planted during the Napoleonic times because it takes 150 to 200 years for French trees to be ready for harvest. They are slow growing, and slower growing trees like this have a much tighter grain. That means that they are going to impart less flavor and they're going to be subtler. The trees in these forests are trained very densely so that they can grow straight, because one of the criteria for oak barrels is that you need a straight portion of the tree. And I'll talk about why in a second. There are other places where species of trees grow for oak barrels in Central Europe, especially Croatia. I mean, Slavonian oak supplies a huge portion of Northern Italy. So that's Croatian oak, Slovakia, Romania, and Hungary. Hungarian oak is number three behind French oak and American oak. Hungarian oak is prized. It has a tighter grain, but some different flavors than what you're going to get in French oak. And people really like Hungarian oak, and it's used all over the place. And the third one is American oak. This is a different oak species. It's Quercus alba. It is grown in Virginia, Missouri, Kentucky, Oregon, Ohio, Minnesota, Wisconsin, California. These oak trees grow a lot quicker than the European ones. They grow about twice as fast. So it only takes 80 to 90 years for harvest. Wider grain. They can be sawn instead of split. I'm not going to get into all of this, but American oak is a lot less expensive. Let's talk about sustainability from the French perspective mainly. Some American forests, not all, are regulated. In France, 70% of the forests are regulated. So, Amy, I hope that we've answered your first question, which is the evolution of oak aging and oak barrels. We got how these winemakers get the barrels. And now I want to get to the sustainability question. In France, this is going to sound really bad. Per tree in the forest, you get 3 to 4 barrels. That means that you're using very, very little of the tree that you have grown and designated for a French oak barrel. It sounds really bad, but oak is very sustainable in terms of raw materials. The tree gets used like this. The bottom of the tree is about 20 to 25% of the tree. The staves for barrels are included in that. Then you use what's left over for oak chips and other barrel alternatives. And then you might use trimmings and sapwood and bark for fuel. The middle of the tree might bend a little bit. That is not straight enough to use for barrel staves, but you can still make a stave out of it and toast it. You would just put it inside of a stainless steel or concrete tank, and that would give some oak flavor to the wine without aging it in oak. It's a lot less expensive. The middle of the tree is used for that. And if it's not used for that, they usually use that middle of the tree for furniture and for flooring and other things. The top of the tree, if it's straight, they might use it for wood beams, and the branches and all the other stuff they're going to use for particle board, they're going to use for fertilizer, they're going to use for fuel. So the entire tree is actually used. They don't use a lot of the tree to make barrels, but the rest is used for green energy and for building materials and things like that. So in France, the forests are sustainably managed. The surface area of forests has actually doubled in the last 200 years. In the 17th century, French minister Jean-Baptiste Colbert, maybe related to Stephen, who knows, he wanted to make sure that there was going to be enough wood supply for the French Navy to build ships 200 years in the future. I already sort of mentioned that. Colbert planted the first acorns in the Tronchet Forest in 1670. 70% of the wood supply to French cooperages comes from public forests that are managed by the National Forests Office, the ONF, and this is highly regulated. It sounds crazy, but the way that this works is that they oversee the welfare of the forest. They auction off a part of the forest to, wait for it, wood négociants. I'm not kidding. And they sign on to take care of a part of the forest for a set time. Then they harvest it. And when they're done harvesting it, they give it back to the ONF, who then replants it and sets it up so that for the next 200 years, somebody else can make it happen. It is very sophisticated. They generally don't chop down trees or use trees where the wood quality is not going to be good. Their technology allows them to see that, but it is managed. And the thing about forests is this: if we don't use the forests, the land will get sold and it's going to be used for other purposes like cattle ranches or commercial agriculture. It will likely be clear cut. So if you buy the wood barrels, that is giving the forest value and it's giving people an incentive to continue to plant forests, which are hugely important because they reduce the CO2 in the atmosphere. And young trees absorb a lot more CO2 than older trees. The cooperage industry in that way, if it's coming from a managed forest where it's sustainable and they treat it like a sustainable resource and make sure it's renewable, then you have a sustainable and good resource. France has the largest forest in Europe, and they really make sure that regeneration is as natural as possible. They work on biodiversity. There has been some criticism that in their effort to make a buck, they pack it in and they're cutting down things too quickly. But certainly on balance, they are thinking about long-term sustainability a lot more and have since 1670 when they first started forest management. The thing that winemakers need to do, and again, it's expensive, is that they should really be buying barrels from a place that certifies that these barrels are from a sustainably managed forest. This is a bigger problem if you buy from private forests in France, but those are now regulated actually for sustainability, but especially American oak, where there isn't a government watchdog really. So you don't know whether those forests are being treated well and they're being replanted for the long term. I'll say that in episode 449 with Craig Holm, we talk about some of the issues of sustainability. The main problem for barrels is that when they come over to the US from France, most of them are already assembled. They could assemble them here, but nobody really wants to do that. That's kind of a problem because that means that you're basically just transporting stacked up air. That's not really sustainable. But everything else about an oak barrel is pretty sustainable. All right, Amy, we're almost there. You asked about use and reuse. That's part of the sustainability thing too. We talked about what happens when you fell the trees and you make the barrels and, okay, you're not using a whole lot of the tree, but the rest of the tree is getting used for other things. You're not just leaving it on the ground and letting it do whatever. Well, now you got these barrels. What do you do with them? Well, let's take Bordeaux. Bordeaux, they buy a lot of barrels in Bordeaux because you need these barrels for Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot and Petit Verdot. So lots of barrels. The way that it generally works, about one third of the barrels each year are new. One third is a year old, and a third is 2 years old or older. The goal is to combine all of those together in a blend so you don't get too much new oak character. It's more subtle because as a barrel gets used, it's sort of like a tea bag. You're dipping it in, it's getting less and less flavor, but it may still provide some nice texture. So those second use or third use barrels are nice for smoothing out some of the tannins, for stabilizing color, but they're not going to impart that oak. You'll do that on a third of the wine, but the other two thirds will be subtler. And a producer who's making lighter wine and still wants to use barrels might use older barrels, and perhaps they would buy those barrels from someone else. If we look at what happens to barrels after someone's done with them, they kind of travel around. They have other lives. And again, this is part of the sustainability circle. In Rioja, for instance, some of the more traditional producers don't want new oak. So they're going to buy a lot of used barrels. That's going to round out the wines, but not give those new oak notes. So the Tempranillo and the Garnacha, the Mezuelo, Graciano can marry inside of these older barrels without getting oak character. So that's one place, and there's other wine regions where they will buy used barrels from other places. Also, whiskey and also rum. Well, whiskey's aged in used barrels from all over the world, and they pick them based on what was in them. So I read, actually, it was Wendy Narby who Insider Tasting is her site. She was on the show we were talking about, the Wine and Two Veg site, which is a fantastic podcast if you haven't listened to that. She wrote about how she went to Scotland and she saw barrels from Bordeaux, and some of them were from Sauternes because they wanted maybe a little sweetness. Depending on the flavoring that they want, whiskey producers will buy barrels from all over the world. And then there's the other thing, decorative items and furniture and things like that are kind of popular. Partially that's because with all the red wine inside of these barrels, it's going to darken the wood. It might leave these little shiny tartrate crystals, and it makes for great furniture and candlesticks. And I read about a winery had its door made out of old barrels. So there's lots of different things you can do. If you decide to get rid of a barrel, remember what I said at the beginning. These are wood. They're biodegradable. They're going to go back into the earth. So in that regard, they are also pretty sustainable. If you decided that you just wanted to chop them up and put them in a pile, it wouldn't be that hard for them to biodegrade. I think that in the end, barrels are pretty sustainable. Very large barrels will last a really long time, but are regular barrels going to last as long as a concrete tank or as long as a stainless steel tank? No, but getting rid of barrels and seeing the end of the life cycle is probably a lot better than what you might have to do with a stainless steel tank or a concrete vat. All in all, the story of how we got to oak barrels, the life cycle of them, the interesting things that happen with them, how so many different people discovered how important they are for wine, and then how oak in particular became so important for French wine. It is such an interesting story. So Amy, I just have to thank you. And if any of you have a topic that you're interested in, please let me know, because I had so much fun researching this. This was a fun podcast to do. And I learned a lot. First of all, I learned that the Celts are a bigger group than I thought. I learned all about ox skins. I mean, come on, who wouldn't want to know about that? And then about forestry management, which I also think is very interesting. I knew a little bit about that, but I learned more. I hope you did too. So like I said, if you have an idea, pop it over my way. Thank you so much, Amy. And with that, this has been another episode of Wine for Normal People. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time.